Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, March 15th, 2024. I'm Dave Buzik, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb Martin. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. For this first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news, and then we wrap up, as always, with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Well, we wish you a very pleasant Good Friday morning, and the weather is returned to just a beautiful day. Sunshine returns to the state today with mostly sunny conditions and seasonably warm temperatures in the 50s. But the winds increase by Saturday from the northwest, and with lowering relative humidities, once again, elevated fire weather conditions are expected to develop during the day on Saturday. Cooler air arrives Saturday night into Sunday, with cooler temperatures and highs 10 to 15 degrees cooler on Sunday, along with a brisk northwest wind. The cool conditions are forecast to continue into Monday before warming into the middle of next week. There's little threat of precipitation during this time. Here's the specific day part forecast. Today, mostly sunny, high 57, winds out of the northwest around 10 miles an hour. Tonight, mostly clear, low 40, winds out of the west-southwest at 10 to 15. Saturday, partly cloudy, gusty winds in the afternoon, high 56, winds out of the west-northwest at 20 to 25 miles per hour with higher wind gusts possible. Saturday night, a few clouds and breezy conditions, low near 31. Sunday, partly cloudy, high only 44, winds out of the northwest at 20, gusting up to 30 miles an hour, so doesn't sound all that pleasant. Sunday night, generally clear, low down to 22 degrees, and then on Monday, sunny, high only 43, winds continuing out of the northwest at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Let's take a look at the weather. That does take a look at the weather, and now let's take a look at the front page of the Register with my partner in crime this morning, Barb Martin.
Thanks, Dave. We'll start with one called An Uncertain Future. As a pair of Iowa developers has filed for bankruptcy in federal court, leaving uncertain the future of homes and properties in three states, including some under construction in the Des Moines metro. Court records show creditors are owed millions of dollars, including the luxury vehicle purchases. Jeffrey and Tina Ewing, husband and wife developer from Pella, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in federal court on March 5. Their Vintage Cooperatives real estate business operates homes and independent living communities for people who are 55 years or older in Iowa, including Altoona, Ames, Ankeny, Bettendorf, Coralville, Des Moines, Indianola, Iowa City, Johnston, and Pella. It also has communities under construction or planned in Cedar Rapids, Dubuque, Iowa City, North Liberty, and Waukee, as well as Columbia and Liberty, Missouri, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. At least five homes have been sold at the development in Waukee under construction now. It's unclear how the bankruptcy proceedings may affect those homeowners, though in Ewing's lawyer told the Des Moines Register there's a plan in place to address the issue. The Ewing's other real estate businesses and holdings include Ewing Land Development and Services, LLC, and Harvest Investment, LLC. Vintage Cooperatives Estate of Waukee broke ground in 2022 with a plan to build 29 single-family homes for seniors on 8 acres of the Kettlestone development off Grand Prairie Parkway. The Waukee community's floor plans include 2- and 3-bedroom homes with community amenities including a clubhouse, fitness center, pickleball court, pool, and lounge. Homeowners hold membership stock in the organization, which owns the land, buildings, and common areas. As of September 2023, 5 homes had been sold, according to Vintage Cooperative's website. A Register photographer observed work continuing at the site on the afternoons of March 13, though none of the homes appeared to be completely finished. The Register attempted to contact some metro area creditors listed in federal court records, but did not immediately receive responses. Austin Parker, one of the Kansas City-based attorneys representing the Ewings in federal bankruptcy court, told the Register in a statement that they're working on a plan of reorganization organization that would work to secure each resident in their homes, maintain the high construction quality for which each of these communities have become known, and minimize the dollar returns to not only our construction lending partners, but to the broader list of creditors that have believed in each of these projects. End quote. Parker added that the bankruptcy reorganization also will affect land slated for development in Cedar Rapids and in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, in addition to properties under construction in Waukee and Dubuque and in Missouri. We are confident that each of these communities has a bright future, and we are working very hard to resume their forward progress in the coming weeks, Parker said. Heather Behrens, spokesperson for Waukee, said that the city has not been involved with the issue so far because it's a private development. It would intervene only if construction should have to reapply for building permits or the site became a hazard to the public, she said. Federal court filings list more than 26 pages of creditors whom the Ewings owe, including individual banks, credit unions, credit card companies, construction companies, a landscaping company, an engineering consultant, accounting firms, municipal and county offices, newspapers for advertising expenses, online marketing and communication services, electric companies, and mobile phone and in-car services such as OnStar and Sirius. The Ewings estimated that they owed 100 to 199 creditors. Some of the top creditors, 15 banks, credit card companies, and credit unions, are together own more than $1.9 million. Much of that debt was issued for operating capital. But the Ewings also owe more than $372,000 for a motorhome, more than $52,000 for a GMC pickup truck, more than $71,000 for two luxury SUVs, a Land Rover and a Lincoln, more than $34,000 for a Polaris off-road utility vehicle, and more than $36,000 for a tiny home. Creditors will have the opportunity to meet with the Ewings on April 5 in federal court in Des Moines, according to the court filings. At such a 341A meeting of creditors, debtors are required to answer under oath questions about their conduct, property, liabilities, financial condition, and other matters. Creditors also may ask about assets and other things related in the case. Parker's statement said that Ewing Land Development and Services and several subsidiaries have been negatively affected by a myriad of issues outside of their control, including interest rate hikes since the COVID-19 pandemic. The Ewing's alleged financial issues had been building for months in Iowa courts before they filed for bankruptcy in federal court. South Dakota couple Dan and Ann Clark filed a lawsuit in January of 24 in Marion County alleging that Harvest Investments had pursued and received a $900,000 loan from them in April of 2023 to help finance a private development agreement with the city of Pella. The Clarks alleged Harvest was required to make monthly repayments to them, and if Harvest ever missed a payment, the remaining balance and accrued interest would be due. The Ewings also were to be personally liable for the loan. Harvest failed to pay, the Clarks alleged, and the outstanding amount was not included in court records. The Ewings also allegedly sold properties that the Clarks had purchased of $152,250 share in. The Clarks say that they are owed more than $20,000 in interest than they alleged was paid to them upon sale of the property. In February of 2024, a West Burlington construction company, By State Constructing, filed a lawsuit in Des Moines County, alleging that Jeffrey Ewing and his companies failed to make progress or to provide evidence of financing for two vintage cooperative communities in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, which left Ewing in default on promissory notes with the construction contractor. Vintage Cooperative's websites for the projects show on March 13 that none of the 35 planned homes at the Cedar Rapids development had been sold as of September of 23, and the Borough of Iowa City development at the intersection of Scott Boulevard and Rochester Avenue was described as proposed. Bi-State Contracting sought for the Cedar Rapids project $300,000 plus interest since April of 23 and another $25,000 in damages. For the Iowa City project, the contractor sought $300,000 plus interest since November of 2021 and another $45,000 in damages. Dave?
And across the top of the front page of today's Register, headline, Unborn Person Bill Scuttled Over IVF Fears. The bill would have raised penalties for causing their deaths. A story by Stephen Gruber Miller. A bill raising penalties for ending someone's pregnancy without their consent will not move forward in the Iowa legislature this year over concerns that it could endanger access to in vitro fertilization, a key Republican lawmaker said. The legislation, House File 2575, would increase the penalties for terminating a person's pregnancy without their consent, and it would have changed the phrase, terminates a human pregnancy, which exists in the current law, to causes the death of an unborn person. The bill defines unborn person as an individual organism of the species Homo sapiens from fertilization to live birth. House lawmakers passed the bill on March 7th, but the Senate Judiciary Committee did not bring up the bill at its meeting on Wednesday, the committee's final scheduled meeting before a legislative deadline today. Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale, the committee's chair, said he didn't put the bill on the calendar because it needed work. Zahn said there were some definite concerns about in vitro fertilization and the negative effects and unintended consequences with that, and that was very problematic for myself, and so that's why I pulled the bill. To advance this year, bills must pass a full chamber and a committee in the opposite chamber by the end of this week. Democrats in the House warned that the bill could jeopardize in vitro fertilization treatment in Iowa after a state Supreme Court ruling in Alabama last month found that embryos frozen as a part of the IVF process are legally protected as children. Alabama lawmakers later passed a bill explicitly protecting IVF clinics and doctors from civil and criminal liability. House Republicans dismissed Democrats' fears during floor debate, saying the bill increases penalties for crimes already in Iowa law. But Representative Stephen Holt, a Republican from Denison who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, said on Wednesday, even though he believes Alabama's situation is different from Iowa's, he understands the concerns about IVF. Holt said, I believe life begins at conception. I also think we have to come to terms with how we're going to deal with the IVF issue. So I understand the concerns there. Holt said he doesn't know if lawmakers will find a way to revive the bill later in this session. He said, but I think that the concerns for IVF, that's certainly a discussion we've got to have before we would move on it. Speaking to reporters yesterday, House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, a Democrat from Windsor Heights, criticized Republicans for originally dismissing Democrats' concerns and saying that the bill had nothing to do with IVF. Confirst said, they got caught running a bill that did more than they said. They mocked us when we said it did that. And then other Republicans pulled the bill because it did just what we said. That is politics at its worst. Democrats in Iowa and nationally have made clear they intend to campaign this fall on access to abortion and reproductive health care. Senator Zahn is seeking his sixth term in the Senate this year. He faces a challenge from Urbandale City Councilmember Matt Blake in what is expected to be the Senate Democrats' top Republican-held target. Zahn won a narrow victory 4 years ago, defeating a Democratic challenger by 2 percentage points. Since he was last on the ballot, his district has become more urban through Iowa's redistricting process. His District 22 includes Johnston, Eastern Urbandale, and some parts of Polk County. He said political concerns did not play a role in his decision not to bring up the bill. Zahn said, I have voted on a lot of pro-life bills in the past. I have a record. You can tell that I'm pro-life. I wasn't worried about this bill or actually any particular bill. I wasn't sent down here to make decisions based on re-election. But I also have a responsibility as chair to make sure that legislation is written correctly. Earlier this week, three Senate Democrats held a news conference urging Republicans to pass a bill guaranteeing a right to contraception, citing the Iowa bill and the Alabama case. Senator Sarah Trone Garriott, a Democrat from West Des Moines, who is also on the ballot this fall, said, "Iowans are watching what's happening in other states, and they're worried. It's time for the Republican majority to join us in standing up for birth control access and protecting procedures like IVF. We must defend the right of Iowans to have a family when the time is right for them." Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum, a Democrat from Dubuque, pointed to Senator Zaughan and other Senate Republicans' 2019 vote in favor of Senate File 523. That bill had similar language about causing the death of an unborn person, which the bill defined as beginning at fertilization. Yoakum said, "I know that Senator Zaughan and Republicans are now claiming that they have killed this bill in the Senate, but let me assure you, in 2019, they all voted for a bill that was very similar on personhood." Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Grimes, said Senate Republicans thought the bill needed too much work. Whitfer said, "We were kind of doing the opposite of what Alabama just rushed into session to do, which was allow IVF. And we just thought it came over fairly late, and we just thought that bill is not ready for prime time, and we're going to put it on the shelf and move on." Governor Kim Reynolds' longtime effort to expand birth control access, House File 2584, also will not move forward this year after failing to gain enough support among House Republicans. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll found 79% of Iowans favor the bill to allow Iowans to receive birth control from a pharmacist without first seeing a doctor. House Speaker Grassley said that he is supportive of the bill and added, "I think it's something we should consider." But he said House Republicans have philosophical disagreements on the subject that have kept it from gaining enough support. Grassley said, "Within our caucus right now, there isn't a level of consensus to be able to move that bill forward." The Senate passed a bill last year expanding birth control, and Whitfer called the idea good policy. He said, "That's a bill I think the Senate has passed probably three times at least over the last few years. It's something obviously this chamber supports. I don't know specifically what their hang-up is in the House. You'd have to ask the Speaker on that." Representative Confirst said Democrats want to expand birth control access and criticized Republicans for not supporting the policy. She said, "If the governor wanted to make over-the-counter birth control available to every Iowan as badly as she wanted to pass school vouchers or gut AEAs, I think we'd see it happen. Except she can't get it done in the House and the Senate because there aren't enough Republicans who want to support over-the-counter birth control for Iowa women."
And now for an Iowa poll, a Register exclusive since 1943, and the title is "Most Want Teacher Pay to Start at $50,000. This is written by Philip Sitter. Sizable majorities of Iowans, both Republicans and Democrats, want to raise a starting pay for public school teachers, according to a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll. The poll found that 76% of Iowans favor raising public school teachers' minimum pay to $50,000 from $33,500, compared with 22% who oppose that step and 2% who aren't sure. Among Democrats, 93% support the pay purchase, compared with 74% of independents and 68% of Republicans. The poll of 804 Iowa adults was conducted February 25 to 28 by Seltzer and Company. It was a margin of error with an error margin of 3.5 percentage points. Lacey Hansen, a 40-year-old Republican poll respondent from Union, who agreed to a follow-up interview, supports the proposed raise for starting teachers. And for her, raising public school teachers' pay is about what goes into being a professional educator. Hansen said that she used to be a paraeducator for 3 years at the Colfax Mingo Community School District. Being paid more at the time would not have kept her in the position. But Hansen said pay does matter for retaining educators. There's a lot more that teachers and school staff have to deal with than the average person really realizes, including training an active school shooter or active shooters at schools, or how to deal with combative students, Hansen said. In January, Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, called in her condition of the state address for increasing the starting pay of public teachers in Iowa from $33,500 to $50,000. That was expected to cost the state about $47 million. We want younger Iowans to see the teaching profession as something that to aspire to, Reynolds said with her address. It's one of the highest callings that one can have, so let's make sure that teachers' pay sends that message. End quote. House Republicans have advanced House File 2630, which would raise the minimum teacher pay to $47,500 for the coming school year and then raise it again to $50,000 the next year. The House proposal also includes $14 million for schools to raise the pay of non-salaried school staff to $15 an hour. The House bill does not include Reynolds' provision to give the teachers with at least 12 years of experience a minimum salary of $62,000, which would cost the state about $26 million. But it does include $22 million for the school districts to increase experienced teachers' salaries. Linda Ray Casey, a 73-year-old Republican poll respondent from Spencer, is among those who oppose giving teachers a raise. I disagree with the teachers in the public school, so I'm not going to promote it by increasing teacher salaries so that more of them will go into that line of thinking, Casey said. Casey said, we need to get back to what the true issue of education is, focusing on reading, writing, and math so children can grow up to be self-sufficient and not depend on government assistance. Casey said that she disagrees with the critical race theory, a course of study that explores how the systemic racism is interwoven over decades into American institutions and policies. It is rarely, if ever, taught in K-12 schools. Iowa Republican legislators and Reynolds have, in recent years, created a law against teaching certain concepts, including that the U.S. or Iowa is systematically racist. The law did not specifically name critical race theory, though Reynolds said it was a target. In higher education, the Iowa House on February 29 passed legislation that included directives adopted by the Iowa Board of Regents in November, requiring Iowans' three public universities to eliminate all staff positions focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion that aren't necessary to comply with state or federal law. Dave.
And we have some breaking national news. D.A. Fannie Willis can stay on the Georgia Trump case if she removes the special prosecutor, according to a judge. The story from the USA Today. In a pivotal decision that could significantly impact the course of Donald Trump's legal and political future, a Georgia judge sharply criticized Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis and said she and her entire office must step down from the election fraud prosecution of the former president or fire the lawyer overseeing it with whom she had an affair. Atlanta-based Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, in a much-awaited ruling, said Willis had created, quote, the significant appearance of impropriety that infects the current structure of the prosecution team, unquote, based on the romantic relationship she admitted having with Nathan Wade, a private attorney she hired to oversee the sweeping case against Trump and 14 others for allegedly trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election in the state. McAfee's ruling is a stark rebuke for Willis, who defiantly insisted she had done no wrong in dramatic court testimony last month and in a sworn affidavit. If Willis refuses to force Wade to step down, Judge McAfee said he would refer the case to the Prosecuting Attorney's Council of Georgia for reassignment, an option that would almost certainly delay the trial well past the November 5th presidential election that will likely see Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, facing off again against President Joe Biden. No trial date has yet been set. Fannie Willis had no immediate comment. Steve Sadow, Trump's head defense counsel, excuse me, said that he was not satisfied with the judge's ruling. Sadow said in a statement to USA Today, "While respecting the court's decision, we believe that the court did not afford appropriate significance to the prosecutorial misconduct of Willis and Wade, including the financial benefits. We will use all legal options available as we continue to fight to end this case, which should never have been brought in the first place," unquote. The Republican-appointed judge had hinted at the possibility of ruling this way last month by asking questions about whether he might only need to find that Willis had created the appearance of conflict of interest by having a romantic relationship with Wade. Defense attorneys for Trump and other defendants seeking disqualification had argued for using that standard, but also said Willis improperly benefited financially from hiring Wade through the vacations that they took together. Prosecutors argued that the defense attorney seeking Willis's disqualification had to prove an actual conflict of interest, and Willis and Wade both testified that she repaid him in cash for her part of the travel. McAfee said Willis needed to be held to a higher standard. McAfee's ruling caps more than 2 months of intense legal wrangling that began with a January 8th court filing by a former Trump 2020 campaign official who accused Fani Willis of engaging in a clandestine and improper romantic relationship with Wade. A private attorney with virtually no experience prosecuting complex cases like the sweeping election racketeering one that he now heads. Willis responded that she hired him more as a trusted manager of the overall investigation and trial than as a prosecutor. The former campaign official and longtime Trump associate Michael Roman said the relationship violated state conflict of interest laws and so irrevocably tainted the case that Willis and the DA's office needed to be disqualified and that the case dismissed entirely. Roman also accused Willis of financially benefiting from the romantic vacations she took with Wade, alleging that he used some of the more than $650,000 in Fulton County money he has been paid on the case for them in what amounted to an illegal form of self-dealing. Trump and several other co-defendants soon joined Roman in the motion to disqualify and in attempting to dig up more information about her relationship with Wade, including cell phone records that might show when they were together. That prompted Judge McAfee, who was appointed to the Superior Court bench in February of 2023 by Republican Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, it caused him to schedule 2 days of evidentiary hearings last month and then a third to hear from all parties. Both days of testimony and cross-examination were marked by combative exchanges. The defense lawyers accused Willis and Wade about lying about key details of their relationship, including when it began and who paid for the trips to places such as Aruba and California wine country.
Brubaker challenges Young for Iowa House District 28 seat. They will have a face-off June 4 in the primary. This is by Philip Sitter. There will be a contested Republican primary in the District 28 State House seat in Dallas County. Former U.S. Representative David Young, a Republican who represents District 28, announced on March 13 his plans to run again for the state legislative district seat. Iowa Secretary of State records showed that Young had filed the same day for the June 4 primary election, has had a fellow Republican, Chad Brubaker of West Des Moines. And District 28 represents areas of Dallas County, including southwestern West Des Moines, Adel, and Van Meter. Young of Van Meter represented Iowa's 3rd congressional district between 2015 and 19 before he lost to Democrat Cindy Axne in 2018 and 2020. Young also was chief of staff for U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley from 2006 to 2013. In November of 2022, Young defeated Democrat Sonia Heitsusen for the District 28 seat. Young said in a news release, "In my first term in the State House, I've stuck to my principles to offer solutions and be a strong voice for my constituents. I seek feedback from my district and stay focused on fighting for their priorities." He wants to continue fighting for a stronger educational system, lower taxes, freedom from government overreach. Young, an adjunct professor at his alma mater, Drake University, is an assistant majority leader in the Iowa House and serves on the Commerce, State Government, Appropriations and Administration, and Rules Committees. His announcement to run again is as an incumbent included an endorsement from Republican Speaker of the House, Pat Grassley. Grassley said, "David is known for sticking to his principles, offering solutions, and doing what he believes is right for his district. He is in touch with the people he represents and is a vocal advocate for the priorities of HD 28. I look forward to continuing to work with him in the Capitol." Now, Brubaker ran in 2018 as a Libertarian against Democrat Jennifer Confist and Republican Michael Bohl for the Iowa House District 43 seat. Confist won that election. Brubaker said Wednesday that he had not run for any office since. He said he wants to be sure that tech giants like the Microsoft and Apple are paying their fair share of property taxes as they expand data centers in the western suburbs. Brubaker does not want Iowa Public Employees' Retirement System to invest in private equity. "I want IPERS to be conservatively invested for our teachers." And he said, "Rather than the school voucher system Iowa has in place that lets families use public funds to pay for their child's private school costs, he'd like every full-time licensed teacher in the state to be paid directly from the state, whether they work at a public or private school." Brubaker credited former 2024 U.S. presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy for bringing him and other libertarian-leaning Republicans back into the GOP. Laura Snyder, a Democrat from West Des Moines, announced on March 12 her candidacy to run for the Iowa House District 28 seat. And that's from Philip Sitter.
And we'll go to the Metro and Iowa section in today's Register. Headline across the top of the page, Iowa House passes school security bill. There's a big picture of a fake Elvis in the middle of the page with the headline, Hawkeye Elvis. We'll let Barb read that one. And then two stories across the bottom, lawsuit settled in Tyson plant workers' COVID deaths, and Pleasant Hill wants to sell a house that's blocking a road project. Let's start up at the top of the page. Iowa House passes school security bill. The grants would help pay for training and arming school staff. A story by Stephen Gruber Miller. Iowa House Republican lawmakers passed a school security bill Wednesday that would create a new grant program for schools to help pay for training and other costs associated with arming staff members and could be used to pay for guns. The bill would also require schools to complete safety reviews, create a task force to make recommendations for new building code standards for school safety, and create a pilot grant program for schools that want to integrate gun detection software with their security cameras. House lawmakers voted 59-35 Wednesday to pass House File 2652, sending it on to the Iowa Senate. All but one Republican voted in favor, while Representative Mark Cisneros, a Republican from Muscatine, joined every Democrat in opposition. The legislation is part of legislative Republicans' response to the deadly January 4th shooting at Perry High School. Representative Carter Nordman, a Republican from Panora, said, "No parent should have to worry about their student's safety. No spouse should have to worry about their significant other coming home from a day of teaching. Schools should be a place for students and teachers to grow and learn. This bill in front of us offers solutions." The measure comes after the House passed a separate bill on February 29th that would allow teachers and other school staff to obtain a professional permit to carry guns on school grounds and provide them with legal immunity for the use of reasonable force. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confist, a Democrat from Windsor Heights, said Democrats support school safety but oppose the bill, because the grant program could allow taxpayer money to pay for guns for school staff. Confist said, "I have concerns fundamentally about spending taxpayer dollars to put more guns in our schools." School districts would be limited to grants of $25,000 under the bill. They could use the money to purchase infrastructure and equipment related to arming staff or to facilitate the required staff training. Schools could also use the money to provide stipends to employees who participate in the training associated with employee permits to carry weapons. An earlier version of the bill budgeted $3 million for the grant program, but Republicans amended the bill to take out the specific dollar amount. The legislation now states the grants shall consist of monies appropriated by the legislature. Representative Adam Zabner, a Democrat from Iowa City, asked a question of Representative Nordman during debate. If that program were to be funded at a later date, would the monies from that program be able to be used by school boards to buy guns? Nordman responded, if a school board decides to, that would be an option. I would foresee school boards using it for other reasons before that. Nordman said the $3 million would serve as a starting point for lawmakers as they decide how much funding to put into the program later in the legislative session. The bill would also require school districts to conduct school safety reviews and share the results with law enforcement, create a task force to review school infrastructure safety and security standards, and require schools to have emergency radios that are capable of contacting law enforcement. The task force would include state and local law enforcement officials, superintendents, a private school president, school board members, building contractors, the state building commissioner, and an official from the State Department of Education. The group would be required to submit its findings to lawmakers by the end of this year. Schools would be required to meet the building safety standards before they could issue bonds for new building construction or renovation of athletic facilities. The bill also spends $3 million on a firearm detection software pilot program. The software would be integrated with the school district's existing security cameras and have to be able to alert school employees and law enforcement if there is a visible unholstered gun on school property. The money for the grant would come from the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management's E-911 program. Cisneros, the Republican who opposed the bill, objected to the bill's requirement that companies offering the gun detection software must receive a special designation from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. He said there are companies in Iowa doing similar work that should be allowed to compete for the grant. The bill also requires every school building to have at least one emergency radio capable of contacting law enforcement by the 2025-26 school year. Nordman said Governor Kim Reynolds plans to use federal American Rescue Plan money to pay for those radios. On Tuesday, House lawmakers passed another bill, House File 2653, which would allow the Perry School District, which suspended classes for weeks after the shooting, to waive state requirements for instruction time. The bill would also allow Perry to use existing funds to pay one-time retention bonuses to school staff. Representative Nordman said, as Perry has talked with other schools that have experienced other tragedies, teacher retention has been one of their toughest hurdles. By allowing these bonuses, it is Perry's hope that they can mitigate losing teachers and staff over the next year.
The man behind the Elvis persona embodies his shared love for the King. This is written by Ryan Hansen. The 7th-ranked undefeated Hawkeye football team took the field at Kinnick Stadium on Halloween in 2009 with an 8-0 record. Gregory Suckow was one of the 7,585 in the stands, a season ticket holder for the last 6 seasons. Some of the capacity crowd was dressed to support their beloved Hawkeyes. Dotting the stands was a Hawkeye Darth Vader, a Hawkeye Captain America, and many other festive Iowa costumes. The collective creativity and the passion for University of Iowa athletics inspired Suckow. It was really cool, Suckow said. So I went back to my mom's house and I said, could you make me a black and gold Elvis jumpsuit that I can wear to the Halloween game next year? Well, a star was born on October 30, 2010, when Suckow dressed up and transformed into Hawkeye Elvis for the first time. He then donned the outfit at a random men's basketball game and did it again a bit later. Suckow remembers wearing the Elvis costume to one or two football games and a few other basketball games. Though he thought of it simply as a novelty, the fans began clamoring for Hawkeye Elvis to make more appearances. Well, when I wouldn't wear it, the people who sat around me would say, hey, how come Elvis isn't here? We got to have Elvis to win the game, Suckow said. As a kid, Suckow often sat in his grandma's basement tossing his mom's Elvis records on an old record player. He quickly fell in love with the King of Rock and rock and roll. Suckow has shared a love for Elvis with his mother, Margaret, for many years. She also spent her childhood listening to the legend. The duo are also passionate University of Iowa fans, though Gregory Suckow was initially torn between the Iowa State Cyclones and the Hawkeyes as a kid. A historic coaching staff and a distinct logo eventually won the young Gregory over. He became a Hawkeye fan. Lute Olson was the basketball coach, and Hayden Fry was the football coach at Iowa, Suckow said. And those were two pretty powerful things for a kid who was interested in sports, and I loved the Tiger Hawk. Hawkeye Elvis hit the big stage in 2014. Gregory Suckow traveled to Chapel Hill with some of his friends on December 3 to watch the Iowa men's basketball team take on the 12th-ranked North Carolina. Hawkeye Elvis was one of a few Iowa fans in the building on a Wednesday night. And with the game tied with 1 minute 16 to go, junior guard Mike Gasell drove right baseline to the rim and flipping in a go-ahead layup. He drew a foul and landed at Suckow's feet. Hawkeye Elvis and his two friends were elated. So was Gasell, whose celebration drew the camera's attention. Right behind Gasell and two of his teammates was Gregory Suckow, decked out in his Hawkeye Elvis gear, highlighted by a black and gold jacket and a jet black wig. He's pictured pointing and shouting excitedly toward Gasell, and his right ring finger bedazzled by a Tiger Hawk ring. Gasell jumps up, and he's celebrating with Adam Woodbury and Jared Uthoff, and I'm standing right there with him, Suckow said. The iconic picture was featured on the front of the Press Citizen Sports section the next morning, while Hawkeye Elvis was prominently displayed in one of CBS's sports photos of the week. Suckow's persona was officially exposed to the sports community. My profile was sort of grew from there, he said. Gregory Suckow realizes his costume isn't unique, yet knows that he's really recognizable. Dressing up as Elvis, no matter the situation, comes with a high profile. In American popular culture and music, there are a few names and few artists that can just stand alone, Suckow said. But literally everybody has heard of Elvis, whether it's in this country or around the world, we've heard of Elvis. Even if you don't like his music or his movies or any of his stuff, you know Elvis, you know him when you can see him. And so it's like, it's just an instantly recognizable icon. Suckow spent nearly 25 years living in Minnesota, making the trek down to Iowa City for most football Saturdays and many weekend basketball games. He joked that he knew the roads from Minneapolis to Iowa City like the back of his hand. Well, not too many of them. Suckow has long been a real estate lawyer. He moved to California in August of 2023, about 30 minutes from San Francisco. He has two kids now at college age, and they were out of the house, and we wanted to take on a new opportunity, though the move created a few challenges for Gregory and Hawkeye Elvis. Gregory Suckow may have chosen the Hawkeyes several decades ago, but he remains his mom's biggest fan. He's still captivated by her charisma and sewing talents. If Mom hadn't worked for that Department of Transportation for 20-plus years, she could have easily gone to Hollywood, worked in a costume department in any studio because she's an amazing seamstress, Suckow said, levying high praise from his mother's work over the years. Margaret has helped create several renditions of the Hawkeye Elvis costume over the years. Now, at age 79, she continues to battle Alzheimer's disease and lives in a memory care facility in Iowa. Documentarian and University of Iowa alum Skylar Knutson, his short documentary highlighted Suckow's relationship with his mother and the value of Hawkeye Elvis' persona as she began battling dementia. Skylar was able to capture so many moments of me and my mom's just being together. You know, I don't know how to say this, but while she was still here before the Alzheimer's and the dementia really diminished who she was, Gregory said, that is why that disease is so awful. Nearly 4,000 people have viewed the documentary. Gregory was shocked by the outpouring of support that he received in person and through emails, many who related to the Suckoff family's fight. Gregory is a staple in the Hawkeye community for more than his outward persona. He's appeared at Hawkeye as Hawkeye Elvis in podcasts and TV interviews and was seen at the Special Olympics Spring Classic March 9-10 in Coralville. One of Gregory Suckoff's most high-profile displays of generosity was when Iowa men's basketball faced off against the Auburn Tigers in last year's 2023 NCAA tournament. Hawkeye Elvis and Auburn's Elvis came face-to-face. The pair bet that the losing team's Elvis would donate to the other school's children's hospital, and each helped raise money for both. The Hawkeyes lost 83-75. Hawkeye Elvis has even appeared at classic car shows, including one a few years ago in Adair, Iowa. Gregory Suckoff refused payment, but after event organizers insisted, he struck a deal. Hawkeye Elvis would attend as long as his payment was donated to the University of Iowa Steed Family Children's Hospital. I'm glad that I've been able to sort of use Hawkeye Elvis to highlight some great causes and some great people, Gregory said.
Lawsuit settled in Tyson plant workers' COVID deaths, a story by Kevin Baskins of the Des Moines Register. Tyson Fresh Meats has settled lawsuits with the estates of three workers at its Storm Lake pork plant who died of COVID-19 contracted in 2020 while the facility continued operating during the early days of the pandemic. Terms of the settlement were not disclosed in court documents, and attorneys for the estates and Tyson did not respond to emails seeking comment. The settlements were reached in Buena Vista County District Court with the estates of Kenneth Jones of Alta and Juan Samadillo and Victor Barahona Rivera, both of Storm Lake. In the lawsuits, their survivors claimed that Tyson Foods failed to take prompt action to space employees apart along its tightly packed processing lines, failed to erect barriers between the workers, and slow the pace of the lines and provide masks and other protective gear. The families also claimed Tyson managers did an insufficient job of testing employees for infections and cleaning the facilities. Quote, Tyson and its managerial employees required Jones, Rivera, and Samadeo to work in an environment rife with coronavirus when they knew or should have known that Tyson wasn't implementing the necessary safety precautions. That's according to attorneys Mary Hamilton, representing the Samudio and Rivera families, and Willis Hamilton, representing the Jones family, writing in almost identical petitions. Tyson responded to the lawsuits by saying the company followed federal government instructions to help avert an impending national food shortage. Storm Lake was among the hardest-hit meatpacking towns in the country. The company reported 1,476 COVID infections through February 20 of 21 at the Tyson pork processing plant there and a turkey processing facility of Hillshire Brands, a Tyson subsidiary. Additional lawsuits included one filed by the estate of Michael Everhard of Fonda, who also died of COVID-19 while working at Tyson Storm Lake plant. They are currently awaiting an Iowa Supreme Court ruling on whether district court or workers' compensation hearings are the appropriate entity to decide wrongful death lawsuits filed by the estates of meatpacking workers.
And Pleasant Hill wants to sell house that's blocking a road project. And Chris Higgins says this. The city of Pleasant Hill could sell you a house if you're willing to move it. The Pleasant Hill City Council approved purchasing about 15 acres just outside city limits, 800 Northeast 64th Street, for $1.45 million from a local landowner in October. The sale was recorded January 2nd. The property will be used for a future extension of Martha L. Miller Drive, completing the roadway from 60th Street to 64th Street. There is no set date for the road extension project, according to city documents. However, there's a snafu. The property has a 1,450-square-foot ranch house built in 1986 and a pole barn from 1995 that would be in the way of the road project. The structures are in good condition and could be moved and reused if someone is interested. Selling the house and barn would save the city on demolition costs. On March 12, the council approved setting a public hearing to receive bids for the home and consider awarding it to a new owner on April 23. The sale would be for the structure and not for any land. The winning bidder would have 3 months to relocate the home and stabilize the site. If the city does not receive or award any bids, the staff could proceed with demolishing it. According to Polk County Property Records, the house has 3 bedrooms, 1.5 baths, a 500-square-foot garage, and a deck. The Polk County Assessor lists the value of the house of the and the land at $235,000. Pleasant Hill has no set asking price and will go with the highest responsive and responsible bidder, according to the bid posting. The home is available for viewing through April 15. Contact City Hall at 515-262-9368. 262-9368 to schedule an appointment with the 48-hour notice. The council's decision was subject to city staff clarifying use of the barn by the previous owner's family, and the current bid does not list the barn. The purchase agreement allowed the seller use of the outbuilding for a year after closing. A city spokesperson said Thursday specific plans for the barn have not been decided and would come to a later date. The pole barn, which is 24 feet wide by 32 feet tall, could either be put up for bid or demolished. The city has been working to connect the pieces of Martha L. Miller Drive, named for a longtime former council member, as an alternative route off University Avenue for local traffic and development. Connecting the road to 64th Street could allow for commercial development, city documents say. Another section of Martha L. Miller Drive, connecting the public safety building with the Southeast Polk School campus, opened last year. The future extension to 64th Street would complete the road by the proposed crossing at Pleasant Hill Commercial Development.
The Des Moines Metro still leads the Midwest in the latest census report. How fast did it grow? Des Moines continues to hold its title as the fastest-growing large metropolitan area in the Midwest, the latest round of estimates from the U.S. Census shows. The annual figures released yesterday show the six-county Des Moines metro grew 3.1% from 2020 to 2023 and retained its first place as the 81st largest metro in the United States. The next fastest growing of the Midwestern metros over that span was Indianapolis at 2.3%, followed by Madison, Wisconsin at 2%. Between 2022 and 2023, the Des Moines metro grew 1.1%, tied with Madison. The Des Moines metro's population, 709,512 at the time of the 2020 U.S. Census, now stands at 737,164. In the Midwest, among all metro's areas, regions with at least one urbanized area of 50,000 people or more, Sioux Falls, South Dakota grew the fastest at 6.3%. It ranks 171st in size nationally at about 304,000. Among other Iowa metro areas, only Iowa City, Sioux City, and Council Bluffs, as part of Omaha, Nebraska's Iowa metro, grew from 2020 to 2023. Iowa City grew 2.7% to 180,000. Sioux City grew 0.04% to 144,000. And Omaha area grew 1.7% to 983,000. Among the others, the Ames metro lost 0.1% of its population between 2020 and 2023. Cedar Rapids metro lost 0.3%. Quad Cities lost 1.3%, the Dubuque Metro lost 0.4%, and Waterloo-Cedar Falls Metro lost 0.2%. Among Iowa counties, Dallas County remained by far the fastest growing at 11.4%, gaining more than 10,000 people from 2020 to 2023 for a total of 111,000. Polk County, Iowa's most populous at 505,000 in 2023, gained 2.6%. Johnson County, home of Iowa City and Coralville, grew 3.1% to 157,000, and Story County was unchanged with a population at 98,566.
TikTok phone call barrage to Capitol Hill backfires by Ken Tran, Washington, D.C. Days before the House overwhelmingly approved a bill that would force TikTok's parent company to sell the app on face or face an effective ban in the U.S., the platform implored users to call their representatives and urge them to vote against the legislation. The social media company's push resulted in a barrage of phone calls to lawmakers' offices, but it did little to persuade members skeptical of TikTok's protections for American users and could have instead fueled their opposition to the app. In fact, the effort likely helped the bill get fast-tracked to the House floor for its inevitable passage. Last week, the bill was approved by the House Energy and Commerce Committee by a unanimous vote, an extremely unusual occurrence for Congress. On Wednesday, the House passed the legislation by an overwhelming bipartisan vote of 352-65. The push ticked off a lot of people, Representative Tim Burkett, Republican of Tennessee, said Tuesday, noting that a number of the callers were children. The legislation's proponents argue that the app, immensely popular with young people for its customized song and dance features on short video clips, poses national security risks. TikTok's parent company, the ByteDance, is based in Beijing and may expose user data to Chinese government surveillance. For its part, TikTok says that it stores all American users' data in a U.S.-based entity, and the storage is solely managed by the company's U.S.-based security. The company's efforts, however, have done little to alleviate concerns. Some lawmakers saw the lobbying campaign from TikTok as future evidence the app is being abused by the Chinese Communist Party, a claim that leaders have raised for years as its popularity skyrocketed. Last week, the app delivered push notifications to users' phone and prompted them to input their zip code to find their members of Congress to urge them to oppose the bill. TikTok used its app to force thousands of Americans to call their members of Congress to oppose banning the app, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, said in a post on X. How are we still having a conversation about whether or not this app could be used to spread propaganda? Many of the calls to lawmakers about the app were emotional and personal. Some callers threatened to die by suicide if Congress banned the app. Such pleas also reinforced efforts against TikTok. The greatest indication I have that TikTok is toxic is the fact that thousands of teenagers called their legislators this week saying that they would kill themselves, yes, literally commit suicide, if Congress made ByteDance sell TikTok, Representative John James, Republican of Michigan, said in a video posted on X. President Joe Biden has said that he would sign the legislation if it reaches his desk, but Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat New York, hasn't committed to considering it in the upper chamber. Instead, Schumer simply promised to review the bill targeting the major social media platform.